before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. Like in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, international leaders felt it necessary to intervene and bring both sides to the negotiating table.
Приехали три министра иностранных дел европейских стран в Киев.
Laurent Fabius, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, Radoslav Sikorsky.
The Ukrainian president and the leaders of the anti-government protests there have agreed on a truce.
The truce was to give talks between President Yanukovych and the opposition a chance.
Just like in 2004, the opposition, or at least its radical faction, the Right Sector, headed by Dmitry Yarosh, had no intention on fulfilling its part of the bargain.
The opposition leaders left saying they may have found a way to end the bloodshed, but they wanted to take the conclusions from their meeting to the people.
It was soon apparent that the people were not happy.
At the same time, Kiev was saying its last goodbyes to the victims of the massacre. It was also welcoming those who came to power at their cost.
Ukraine's parliament has voted for the new speaker of the assembly to become interim president. Alexander Turchynov called on lawmakers to form an interim government by Tuesday. These latest developments follow the dismissal of President Viktor Yanukovych on Saturday.
And they removed Yanukovych, not following the constitutional procedures for impeachment.
The parliament of Ukraine consists of 450 deputies. The constitution of Ukraine requires at least a three-fourths majority to vote. In other words, 338 votes in favor of the impeachment. But only 328 deputies voted yes.
The U.S. State Department almost immediately said this was a legitimate government. And that was part of this effort to get regime change. Instead of trying to find some way to revive the February 21st agreement, where maybe you could bring back Yanukovych in some titular way, that became not a possibility anymore. Then you had Eastern Ukraine resisting, you had Crimea wanting to break away, and things rapidly escalated.
Voters will decide Sunday whether they'll leave Ukraine and join Russia.
The campaign with the slogan, "Together with Russia," has the backing of Moscow.
Crimean authorities, sensing the mood of the populace, fully supported Viktor Yanukovych's decision to postpone the 2013 European Union Association deal and side deeper ties to Russia. As the events in Kiev took their course, Crimean authorities issued a declaration, putting into words the fears of its people. Based on the will of the Crimeans who elected us, we declare that we will not give Crimea to extremists and neo-Nazis seeking to seize power in Ukraine at the cost of the blood of the country and its citizens. After the regime change in Kiev, rumors began spreading in Crimea that the new authorities would be merciless to those that opposed them.
Slava Ukraini!
This led to the pro-Russian demonstrations rejecting the new government in Kiev. On February 27th, the government buildings in the capital of Crimea were seized by pro-Russian protesters. The current Crimean government was dismissed, and the new leader, Sergei Aksyonov, was assigned as the leader of the Crimean Autonomous Republic. On March 16th, the Crimean referendum was held, and the people voted to leave Ukraine and enter the Russian Federation.
The situation in Crimea is being presented as a Russian invasion. And again, nobody who looks at this seriously and looks at the poll numbers, some of the poll numbers done by the U.S. government agencies themselves, showing that the people of Crimea preferred being part of Russia. In the U.S. news media, it has all been presented as the Russians invaded, they then staged a sham election with people with guns at their backs. Somehow they faked the ballot boxes to get 96% approval for rejoining Russia.
The idea of a referendum in Crimea is just quite simply unconstitutional.
But it does raise questions on whether this vote really is free and fair, especially given the heavy military presence in Crimea right now, Errol.
So that's how it's been sold to the American people. The reality is very different.
The atmosphere here certainly is electric. Thousands of people who've gathered in the capital Crimean city of Simferopol, all of this following a referendum held last Sunday in which the majority of people here overwhelmingly voted in support of being reunited with Russia.
As long ago as 1804, Sevastopol's naval base became the main military port of the Russian Empire on the Black Sea. During the Second World War, the heroic defense of Sevastopol lasted almost a year and took hundreds of thousands of lives. Therefore, the naval base in Crimea has a legacy of historical pride for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, as well as being of huge strategic importance.
Those of us alive back then remember when there were Soviet missiles put into Cuba, how frightened Americans were and how angry, and how we almost went to a nuclear confrontation over having weapons of that kind of destruction placed that close to the United States.
If the United States considers Cuba to be in its backyard, then Crimea lays at Russia's doorstep. In early spring of 2014, eastern Ukraine was also buzzing with protests against the new authorities in Kiev. This region, with the population close to Russia geographically and culturally, feared that the ultra-right leanings of the newly formed government would bring neo-nationalism to their lands. And they had their reasons. The status of the Russian language in Ukraine has been a stumbling block for many years.
Implementing Russian as a second state language was one of the main campaign promises of President Viktor Yanukovych.
In 2012, the Yanukovych government passed a law making it the second official language in the southern and eastern parts of Ukraine, the areas where the Russian-speaking population makes up a majority. Ukrainian nationalist groups initiated massive protests opposing the law. An observing viewer might see some familiar faces there. On February 23, 2014, the very next day after the regime change, the new government voted for an annulment of the official status of the Russian language. And even though later this decision was vetoed by the acting president, Alexander Turchinov, it still sent a message, and a powerful one. This alarmed the Russian-speaking cities of eastern Ukraine, and people took to the streets to show their disagreement. In response, pro-Maidan groups conducted their own demonstrations. When the two parties would meet, it was always tense, and eventually it led to tragedy. One person died and over 50 people were wounded in clashes during a pro-Russian march protesting the new government in Kiev. On April 6th, the Crimean scenario began repeating in eastern Ukraine, where protesters seized government buildings. And the next day, April 7th, they proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Kiev replied by announcing the beginning of an anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine. By that time, the international media was screaming about a Russian invasion in Ukraine.
Russia could now be on the verge of invading Ukraine.
But strong words stayed only in the media. The Ukrainian authorities never announced a warlike situation. Why? IMF cannot give money to countries engaged in ongoing war, Petro Poroshenko. Too much money was already invested in Ukraine to stop halfway.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals that will ensure a secure and prosperous and democratic Ukraine.
Obviously, the funds had to keep coming, and the conflict had to keep going. Getting more and more bloody and deadly, as parties from both sides were using more sophisticated and lethal weapons. The world seemed too busy welcoming this new democracy in Kiev to notice what was being done as it spread its wings over the country. Many in southern Ukraine had been viewing the revolution with concern. And an anti-Maidan movement formed in the city of Odessa in early January 2014. The protesters set up their camp in front of the Trade Union House, a building which would soon become a monument to a massacre of its own. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Odessa. It is strategically located on the Black Sea, and it's Ukraine's largest seaport. It's not surprising that Ukraine's new authorities were watching the situation unfolding there with growing alarm. More and more of Odessa's people were joining the anti-Maidan movement at the same time as events in eastern Ukraine were heating up. The new Ukrainian government didn't have the power to wage war on too many fronts. If Odessa were to join the growing uprising in the eastern regions, it would seriously complicate the situation. This rebellion had to be extinguished immediately and at any cost, and that cost was high. On May 2, 2014, soccer fans flocked to the center of Odessa City for the Ukrainian championship match. Surprisingly, a great number of these fans who descended into Odessa just the night before also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units, along with members of radical organizations from all parts of Ukraine. These fans, masked, armed, and shouting nationalist mottos, began disturbances in the center of the city as they marched to the anti-Maidan tent encampment, where they attacked. The anti-Maidan protesters sought shelter in the Trade Union House, but it was a trap. Maidan supporters started throwing Molotov cocktails into the building until it was engulfed in flames. People burned to death inside, or, trying to escape, jumped from the windows. Although a fire station was less than a mile away, it took almost half an hour for firefighters to arrive. When they finally did, the damage had been done. But here's an intriguing fact. Just a few days before those dreadful events, a messenger from Maidan, Andriy Peruby, made a visit to Odessa. It's an interesting coincidence that some of the people he met with in Odessa were seen at the scene that fateful day. But not everyone was mourning. On the popular political talk show, Schuster Live, the news about the people burnt alive in Odessa was welcomed with a long round of applause. On its Facebook page, the Right Sector announced the events of May 2nd, a proud moment in national history. An official investigation into this sad event has been going on now for nearly 2 years, and it's yet to reach a conclusion. But it seems the experts had all the information they needed from the very beginning. It looks like Odessa really is a very important piece of real estate, as it was honored with a very special new governor appointed on May 30th of 2015. Mikhail Saakashvili, an old friend of the United States and born and raised in Ukraine's neighboring country, Georgia.
A little hoedown there in Georgia.
A quick look at his biography gives one an understanding that he's been groomed for a special mission. Mr. Saakashvili received a U.S. State Department scholarship, and he worked for a New York law firm which represented the organization Kamara, a group that appeared earlier when we learned about the color revolutions.
We are dealing with democratic, bloodless revolution.
This is the Revolution of Roses, and this is Mikhail Saakashvili with Kamara, busy overthrowing the legitimately elected president, Eduard Shevardnadze. Soon after the Rose Revolution blossomed fully, Georgia announced its intentions to join NATO and plant fresh NATO military bases in the fertile soil right on Russia's border.
Never ever we will give our freedom and independence. Never ever we will give any piece of our territory.
Saakashvili's mission was accomplished, at least with his friends and NATO. The Georgian populace wasn't quite as happy, though. In 2007, they took to the streets to voice discontent. And Mr. Saakashvili responded with force. The people's discontent grew. Saakashvili's party lost parliamentary elections, and the opposition took control.
He said, "This means that the parliamentary majority should set up a new government and me as the president, according to our constitution."
Mikhail decided not to wait for the results of the president's election and fled the country in October 2013. In 2014, Saakashvili refused summons to appear in court as a witness in several criminal cases. Later that same year, he was accused of misuse of power and embezzlement. Saakashvili wound up in the U.S., and soon his friends in Washington found him a new assignment. Mikhail actively supported Maidan, and very soon was rewarded with a high position in the new Ukrainian government. First as the president's counselor, and then as the governor of Odessa. The day before taking this position, he renounced his citizenship to Georgia, the country of his birth, and became a Ukrainian citizen. As they say, the battle is worth the blood, both literally and figuratively. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, paid a visit to Saakashvili just a month after he took office in Odessa.
"But as long as the Oblast administration is delivering results on Ukraine, you are going to see a steady flow of embassy and Washington visitors coming here."
The meeting was fruitful, and Jeffrey generous. No matter how well Saakashvili's job goes, it looks like he shouldn't be worried about his own finances. On his Facebook page, he posted an official document showing that the new governor of Odessa gets a pretty penny from Washington, almost $200,000 a year. For comparison, the governor of Maine gets $70,000 a year. So if Odessa became a new U.S. state, it would be at the top of the list. Mr. Saakashvili should feel right at home in his newly adopted country. He is best of friends with fellow color revolutionary leader Viktor Yushchenko, who's the godfather of his son. A war, once launched, doesn't choose its victims.
"We are just learning at this hour that Malaysian Airlines has now confirmed that it has lost contact with one of its planes.
The plane was indeed shot down by a missile while flying at a high altitude over eastern Ukraine near the Russian border. 298 revised number of souls on board, all feared dead."
"It was a murder. It was a crime. There's been this odd nonchalance about pursuing the answers. There was a report, a very limited report, put out a few months after the event. But since then, they said the next report will be on the first anniversary of the event. But you deal with a criminal investigation before it becomes a cold case. So there's been this curious element of why is there not greater pressure from both the media and the Western governments to answer these questions."
But even without any answers, the fingers were pointed immediately.
"That's not an accident. That is happening because of Russian support. Evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile that was launched from an area that is controlled by Russian-backed separatists inside of Ukraine."
The Malaysian Boeing wasn't the first plane to play a significant part in American-Russian relationships. On September 1, 1983, Korean Airlines Flight 007 from New York to Seoul via Anchorage was shot down by a Soviet interceptor aircraft over the territory of the USSR in the Sea of Japan.
"There was absolutely no justification, either legal or moral, for what the Soviets did."
The tragedy of the Korean Boeing was considered a perfect occasion to demonstrate the NATO military power within dangerous proximity to the Soviets. On November 2, 1983, NATO launched Able Archer, a 10-day command post exercise simulating a conflict escalation, culminating in a nuclear attack. It was followed by placing Pershing II nuclear missiles in Europe. What Reagan didn't take into consideration was the paranoid overreaction of the Soviets. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence report shows that for the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was that close to nuclear war. Just like in 1983, the Malaysian Boeing crash was leveraged against the enemy. A new wave of sanctions hit Russia immediately after the tragedy.
The United States is imposing new sanctions in key sectors of the Russian economy.
Almost a year and 3 months later, the Dutch Safety Board published a report.
Ladies and gentlemen, flight MH17 crashed because of a 9N314M warhead detonated outside the aeroplane above the left side of the cockpit.
The report didn't blame any specific group or person and estimated a very wide area of 320 kilometers as a zone from which the missile was fired. At the same time, the Russian producer of Buk missiles, Almazante, conducted its own independent investigation. During the experiment, they blew up a retired airliner with a Buk missile and came to the conclusion that the Malaysian plane was brought down by the older type of missiles, not used by Russia anymore, but still in the possession of Ukraine. The company claims that the missile was launched from the territory controlled by the Ukrainian military. One would expect that these controversial results would again stir up public interest in the investigation, but the tragedy of Malaysian flight MH17 had already played its role in the big geopolitical game. Therefore, it was soon forgotten. The goal was achieved. After the third wave of sanctions hit Russia, the tensions between the two countries skyrocketed. So the question presents itself: are we truly witnessing the beginning of Cold War 2.0? And if so, what are our chances to survive at this time? In 1947, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists introduced the Doomsday Clock. It represents a countdown to global nuclear annihilation. In 1953, during the height of the Cold War, it came its closest to midnight as the superpowers were creating massive nuclear arsenals.
This is the story of America's ever-expanding atomic weapons program.
As the world began to grasp the insane danger of nuclear warfare and took measures to control the arms race, the situation steadily improved. In 1991, the Doomsday Clock was at its furthest from midnight. 17 minutes. That time of hope was short-lived, though, as the world has become more and more unstable. But in 2015, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the clock to just 3 minutes to midnight.
Today, unchecked climate change and a nuclear arms race resulting from modernization of huge arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity.
The United States and Russia have embarked on massive programs to modernize their nuclear arsenals, undermining existing nuclear weapons treaties. The clock ticks now at just 3 minutes to midnight because international leaders are failing to perform their most important duty: ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
While many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter, gas giant BP achieved an $8.2 billion in profits in the third quarter. Britain is facing a severe energy crisis exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Truth Out wrote, the London-based oil and gas giant BP reported that it brought in a staggering $8.2 billion in profits in the third quarter, more than doubling its total from the same period last year, amid Europe's worsening cost of living crisis. The company announced it will be using its banner profits to buy back $2.5 billion worth of its own stock, rewarding shareholders as millions of people across the UK are having trouble heating their homes ahead of the winter season. According to the Financial Times, BP has repurchased more than $10 billion of its shares this year. The advocacy group Global Witness estimates that BP's $27 billion in profits over the past 12 months could pay the energy bills of 9.4 million UK households. Big fossil fuel firms making eye-watering profits is a slap in the face for the millions of citizens struggling to heat their homes, cook their meals, or buy everyday essentials, said Jonathan Noroha Gand, senior fossil fuels campaigner at Global Witness, adding, as winter fast approaches, a dividing line is emerging. Whose side is the government on? Brits facing financial hardships or an industry that's making billions in profits off the current energy crisis? The UK's Conservative government unveiled a windfall profit tax on energy companies in May, but it has thus far had little impact on oil giants. Shell reported last week that it had paid nothing in windfall taxes in the country, and BP said it expects to fork over $800 million, a fraction of the gains it has reaped from global energy market chaos spurred by the Russia-Ukraine crisis. BP's latest earnings announcement sparked calls for a more aggressive windfall tax, as Jeremy Hunt, the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, is expected to unveil a new economic plan later this month. The Guardian reported that Hunt is considering increasing the windfall tax by up to 5 percentage points to 30% and extending its lifespan by 3 years to 2028. The government of new right-wing Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is also facing pressure to reverse plans for deep public spending cuts, which could be devastating for millions of people across the country. Freya Atchison, oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, said in a statement that the announcement of yet another obscene profit for a climate-wrecking oil firm highlights the scale of the pain that these companies are inflicting on the public. While fossil fuel companies are being allowed to make record-breaking profits, households are facing astronomical energy bills and millions are being pushed into fuel poverty, Atchison said, adding, bosses and shareholders at these big polluters are being allowed to get even richer by exploiting one of our most basic needs. BP is also worsening climate breakdown and extreme weather by continuing to invest and lock us into new oil and gas projects for decades to come. BP's profit report came just hours after U.S. President Joe Biden warned fossil fuel giants that he has prepared to support a windfall profit tax if the companies continue gorging on their own stock while refusing to lower costs for consumers. Biden, in a speech at the White House, said, "Oil companies' record profits today are not because they are doing something new or innovative. Their profits are a windfall of war." Murray Auchincloss, BP's chief financial officer, declined to comment on Biden's speech when pressed by Reuters. In a statement recently, Danielle Willis of the UK-based advocacy group Global Justice Now noted that Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Total Energies have announced combined profits of more than $170 billion this year. To put this into perspective, that is more than $116 billion a year that loss and damage are estimated to cost the Global South to date, Willis said, adding, "It doesn't take much to connect the dots to see what's happening here. When fossil fuel companies are announcing record profits just days before COP27, it's high time leaders join those dots once and for all, too, and make polluters pay up for loss and damage. It's clear they can afford to, and a polluter tax could help reduce household energy bills closer to home as well. People here and the Global South have one thing in common when it comes to companies like BP. They're ripping us off and think they can keep getting away with it at the expense of people and the planet," Willis added. "It's high time we showed them the game is up." RT had a report on the UK energy crisis, writing, "UK households face very, very hard winter. Brits will have to pay twice as much for energy in the coming months," the operator National Grid has warned. "Many British households will struggle to pay energy bills this winter that could be double what they are accustomed to, despite a government price cap," the National Grid CEO John Pettigrew has warned. In an interview with the Financial Times, he said he was under no illusions and that Brits would find the upcoming winter financially very, very hard. "Even with the taxpayer-funded price cap, this is a doubling up of what people are used to paying for their energy bills," Pettigrew said, adding, "Therefore, inevitably, there are going to be people who are going to struggle." The British government has capped the unit cost of energy until April, meaning that an average household would pay about £2,500 over a year on average. But last winter, the equivalent amount was £1,277. Each household will also receive a £400 rebate on utility bills, with additional means-tested payments through social security benefits. However, that will still be unable to make up the difference given the soaring energy prices. Pettigrew said the National Grid was working on a number of emergency plans to protect the UK against a shortfall of energy from Europe. Earlier, the grid operator's boss warned that the country could face power cuts on really cold evenings this winter due to Europe's continuing energy squeeze. He said that rolling blackouts could happen during those deepest, darkest evenings in January and February, likely between 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Such measures were unlikely, according to Pettigrew, who warned, however, that there were potential scenarios where Britain's power generators would fail to secure sufficient supplies from Europe. Normally, during the coldest months and extreme weather events, the UK imports gas and electricity from continental Europe for its gas-fired power plants. However, This year, European countries are themselves facing a severe energy crisis, exacerbated by anti-Russian sanctions and a sharp decrease in Russian energy supplies.
Yani.
Bazaar.
If you look around, nearly every object you see is made of raw material extracted from a mine. Basically, if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. The extraction of minerals, metals, and fuels from the ground is one of humankind's oldest industries. Never more than now has society been so dependent on greater variety and larger volumes of mined products. So it's no surprise that mining fuels our modern world and makes economies grow. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we will be exploring the mining industry while shining the spotlight on the machinery used in this sector. We wanted to see what types of machines are used and who is actively manufacturing them. Plus, we wanted to understand why the mining sector is crucial to the national economy and how manufacturers contribute to its progress. So, let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to Shahrud city in Semnan province, where we visited a company specializing in manufacturing various mining machines. With nearly 20 years of experience, this knowledge-based company is active in a host of fields. It conducts research, development, and production of equipment needed in various industries. That being said, it also manufactures a variety of excavating, drilling, trenching, and digging machines. The life of any product begins in the design room. This company has researched and developed these machines and has perfected their performance. Optimizing the machine size, speed, and power to carry out tasks has also reduced the expenses related to projects where these machines are used. These machines can be used in agriculture and road maintenance, among other medium-scale construction projects. Most materials needed to make these machines can be purchased inside Iran. Steel sheets, gears, wires, and whatever else is required to build the machine can be domestically found. And if a design requires a particular part, this company can make its own molds to create the parts. You might find it interesting that these machines are currently imported as there is a high demand among mining companies for equipment. So, indigenizing the production of mining machines has been a big step towards supporting this sector. Another benefit to local production is it saves the country millions by cutting back on imports. The beating heart of this knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here is where all the magic happens. This area employs some of the most talented and experienced specialists to research, design products, and optimize existing ones. But that's not all. The research and development department also studies future projects. This company also dabbles in making equipment used to harness renewable energy. This company not only uses its own expert staff, but also stays up to date on the latest knowledge by maintaining links with the Industrial University of Shahrud. It collaborates with academic institutions and exchanges knowledge with them too. Furthermore, this knowledge firm also uses capacities and resources made available by Semnon Tech Park. Among its services, it offers the execution of projects through contracting. For example, it has used its machines to complete piping and installation of telecommunications manholes for intercity networks. Another example is carving drainage systems in agricultural fields using its trenchers. Over the years, this company has made a variety of award-winning machines, such as drilling machines equipped with fiber optic lights. Moreover, this company has invented 6 products that have been internationally patented. This knowledge-based manufacturer has never stopped eyeing the future and has plans to expand its production units and product portfolio in the coming years. The company we just mentioned is part of the puzzle that helps Iran's mining sector thrive. It is one of Iran's key industries, as the country is one of the top 10 mineral-rich nations globally. Roughly 7% of global mineral reserves can be found in Iran, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Numbers from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show that last year the sector saw a growth in exports. Government officials, however, say export figures could still be much higher. Furthermore, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized production, such as mining machines, in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role.
Okay, time for me to take a little break from here and divert your attention to a report that I made earlier in the week. Everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. Today, we are discussing energy production, specifically electricity production through gas turbines and some of the problems that come with it. So, in different times of the year, mainly during the summer, we get sporadic blackouts at peak hours, at one of the peak hours, let's say around 12 at noon until 4 to 5 p.m. Because we cannot store electricity, electricity production must always match electricity consumption. But because of the temperature during these hours, during this time of the year, during the summer, temperature, high temperatures in particular, negatively affect electricity production through gas turbines. So first we're going to take a look at, well, why that is and how gas turbines work. But and also, we believe that we have found a solution at Sharif Innovation Center in one of the companies that has made that solution, and we're going to check that out too. Why do high temperatures negatively affect the performance of a gas turbine? Well, bear with me as I try to explain how a gas turbine works through this prototype that they have here. This is the prototype of the device that would be used at scale. This is not at scale. So imagine this is the gas turbine. How it works is that it sucks air through these air ducts, and the temperature of that air is very important. I'm going to get back to that. The air goes through a compressor here. The compressor compresses the air, which we would need the compressed air for the combustion chamber. A combustion chamber essentially makes this work exactly like a plane engine or a car engine. A car engine is slightly different because the movement that it produces is linear, whereas the plane engine has rotary movement. So that's exactly what it is like, because it produces rotary movement. So in the combustion chamber, we add a certain type of gas to the compressed air, and then a little spark creates an explosion, and the explosion, the high pressure air, would then spin our turbines. And the turbines, which have movement in them, are connected to a generator, and the generator's job is to turn movement into electricity, which goes through the power grid and then gets to whoever needs it. Now, the thing here, the important thing about the air temperature is that we need ideal conditions, ideally, for the machine to work at peak performance. And that ideal condition is at sea level 15 degrees Celsius. So the air, ideally, is 15 degrees Celsius, but we don't get that kind of temperature in a lot of places, especially in a hot and dry climate. So we have a couple of options to alleviate that problem. Number one, the inefficient option is to work the compressor a lot more, which would use a lot more energy, but that's not even the issue. The issue is that there's a lot easier of a way. So what they have found at TEPCO company is that they have instead tried to use an ice storage unit to work as a thermal storage compartment, because the thermal storage capacity of ice is 100 times more than that of the water. So here they create ice essentially at midnight until the morning when no one is using the power and the air is colder, because that is what happens. The difference between temperatures during the day and temperatures during the night in dry climates is pretty massive. So it's a lot easier to create the ice during that time. So they do that so that in the morning or at noon during peak hours, 12 p.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m., they have the ice to cool the water that is in the storage, and the cooled water goes through a radiator behind the air duct so that the air, the probably hot air that comes through the chamber, is cooled using the water that is in the ice storage compartment. That water cools the air down to like 15 degrees and gives us ideal conditions to work with. So the compressor doesn't need to work that hard. We get our ideal conditions through the ice storage unit. And that is how they are able to offset the amount of electricity that we would lose if we were to use the compressor a lot harder. And that's pretty much how a gas turbine works as well, but also this is the innovation here. A better way to cool the air and get a gas turbine to work at peak performance. There are other less efficient methods of cooling the water that comes through the chamber. Both of them are called evaporative cooling. The first type is done through a wet media, most likely a cooling pad that you see in water coolers everywhere. So how it works is that there is a lot of surface and they run water through it, and the air is going to go through this cooling pad. So as the air goes through the cooling pad, the water absorbs the heat from the air and evaporates. Evaporation is an endothermic procedure, which is heat absorbing, which means that the heat is absorbed from the air and transferred to the water, which evaporates, making the air that runs through the cooling pad a lot cooler. This is a rather wasteful method because, well, you're using water, because in the method that I showed you, you don't use water. The water is just circulated back into the system. This one, you use water, and it's just generally not that efficient. The other method is even more inefficient. You see it in a lot of places in like outdoors restaurants. They spray water through the air that is going to go through the chamber, and the extremely tiny water droplets absorb the heat from the air and evaporate as they are sprayed. This also absorbs heat from the air, and that is why when you go through the spray of water, you feel a cool breeze, because the air is a lot cooler, because its heat is transferred to the water molecules. So both of these methods are pretty inefficient, and I just wanted you to know about other methods that are used, but they are definitely more inefficient. And the chart is a demonstration of how our thermal storage system would perform in an actual 400 megawatt hour power plant system. When the ice is getting used during in midday, it bumps up the production by a difference of 60 megawatts in a regular 400 megawatt hour power plant. And this is how it would theoretically work if it were to be implemented in power plants across the country. All right, now it's time for me to take a little break here and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who's prepared a report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. in the modern world today, felt or nomad has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company, that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called nomad, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Nomad Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reached the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is this phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's this whole thing, we call it desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. and the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is a heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Just like this linear lighting, almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, this linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen. I've been Sarah Dema.
We are almost out of time for our program today, but before we go, let's look at news and trends in the mining sector and its related trades. Here's a brief overview of the country's mining markets and exporting activities this year, based on figures from the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization.
A total of over 20 million tons of minerals and mining industry products were exported in the first half of the Iranian fiscal year. These exports are valued at $5.6 billion, according to the IMM LDRO report. Steel products championed the top of export charts with an aggregate value of $2.5 billion. These products include iron ore, semi-finished, and finished steel. In terms of tonnage, cement and clinker topped the list with over 6 million tons. Last year, Iran exported a record high of nearly $12 billion worth of minerals and mining products.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Let us know what you think about this sector by dropping us a line via our email. Thank you for tuning in. It's bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his allegations about fraud in the 2000s.